image? I mean, what is its purpose?
This I can't answer you. I don't know. I can't answer that question.
I just thought I'd ask it.
Yeah, I mean, he's not a Kohen Gadol, so that wouldn't enter. Yichus, I can understand. They want to make sure, you know, that both parties are legitimately Jewish, and therefore they want to know the name of the father, the name of the mother, etc., etc. Look, I know that, you know, they do it as a normal course in the Bet Din in Eretz Israel. That, you know, before a couple can get married, so they ask them these questions and so on, you know, who is your father, who is your mother. If they come from abroad, then they want to find out more about the Yichus and so on. But even my son, for example, when he made Aliyah, you know, so he took a job. He was going to, he applied for a job working in the military industry, you know, as an accountant, because that's his field, okay? And the Israeli FBI, so to speak, you know, they made inquiries and they wanted character witnesses. I mean, to the fact, you know, that he is who he says, who is his father, his mother, and so on. So, among the witnesses were two people who happened to know David from Springfield. One of them is Dr. Buchwald. He was given, yes. Joshua Buchwald. He used to live over here, right, and they've been living in Yerushalayim for about 10 years now. But, you know, they knew David from... from here, and another one is Rabbi Weisvogel's son-in-law, David Brandris, you know, the one that's married to Rhoda, right? And you know, also after all, they know, you know, they know David, you know, from Springfield, so that they gave testimony, you know, to the fact, you know, that they know David, they know his parents, etc., etc., and so on. You know, it's a legitimate person, and so on. So you know, they do check up, but the business about the virginity, this I do not understand. I've never heard a bride being questioned on that, because as we learned before, it only really makes a difference as far as the Kohen Gadol is concerned. Kohen Gadol is, by the law of the Torah, not permitted to marry other than a virgin. But if a person is not the Kohen Gadol, and nobody is, no matter how tall they are, is a Kohen. So in that particular case, this is not a relevant question anymore. But you know, there are other relevant questions, not only who are your parents, are you Jewish, and so on and so forth, but obviously, have you been married before? If you were married, did you have a get and things like that, you see? Who performed the marriage? Were there legal witnesses and stuff like that, you see? That they have a right to ask, because they want to find out, you know, whether you've complied with all the laws that pertain to Jewish marriage. Just as, for example, if a couple come in to get married over here in Springfield, they have to sign, you know, in the presence of the clerk, you know, that either they've been, that they've never been married before, or if they were married, did they have a divorce, or are they widowed, and things like that, and so on. Because otherwise, you know, there's a possibility of fraud taking place. So, you have to comply with the rules and the regulations. All right. So, getting back to the chassan over here, the Mishnah then continues and says that he is freed from reciting Krishna the first night, and how many nights does he have in case he didn't get around to it as yet? As I explained, I mean, he might have been tired out, she might have been tired out, maybe she was just getting over her period or something like that. This happens too, by the way, that, you know, they plan a wedding for a certain date, figuring that the woman's period is normal, and lo and behold, something happens and she has her period at a time other than that. So in that case, obviously, the chassan and kala can't live together. They can't sleep together, you know, until the time, you know, that she can go to the mikveh and become clean, so that she would be permitted to her husband. This is also something that will happen from time to time. I know a case personally, I mean, where it happened. And it wasn't until the day after the marriage that she was finally able to go to the mikveh. So what did they do? So, you know, the Gemara discusses what you should do on the time. That he spent the whole night with his chever over there, his friends from the yeshiva, all night long, and, you know, she was with her family and so on. and they were not permitted, of course, you know, to be together until the following day when she went to the mikveh, and then, you know, they were able to go and to begin living together. So under these circumstances, it doesn't always happen that the first night, you know, is the night in which consummation takes place. Sometimes consummation takes place on the night other. So how many nights then do they give a chasen according to the Mishnah? The answer is until Motzei Shabbos, which makes sense, as I said, if you say that the wedding took place on Wednesday night, so it means they give them Wednesday night, Thursday night, Friday night, or Saturday night. And maybe the odd doesn't include Saturday night. Actually, probably it doesn't include it, because there's always a discussion in the Talmud as to whether odd means odd v'ad bichlal, or odd v'lo ad bichlal. Ad bichlal means, and that includes also the date that is mentioned under ad. But ad below ad bichlal, it means that it does not include that. So here I'm inclined to feel also that this is an ad, the ad lo bichlal. In other words, it would give him Wednesday night, Thursday night, Friday night. If by that time he still hasn't had a chance to do it, you better say Krishna. Stanley. Well, that's another story. Yeah. The question is, should he recite Krishna? That's what the point is. Okay, this is what we're discussing. Not when actually will the consummation take place. That I only brought in by virtue of the fact because it says Ad Motzei Shabbos. Okay, so what is the meaning of the Mishnah over there? So this is what I'm explaining. But obviously, I mean, if she has a period and it takes more than just a few days, there's nothing they can do. They have to wait until she counts, you know, the clean days, the seven clean days, Shiva Nikim, as we say. And then after that, you know, she goes to the mikveh, and then they can start and live together. But what should he do? The answer is, he's expected to recite Krishna, because he's not engaged in the mitzvah of trying to do this. Now, as we're going to learn later on, Bizman Hazeh, at this in our days, we say every chasen is expected to recite Krishna that night. Because
including the first night.
Why? Because we say, as we'll see in the Mishnah as we continue, okay, the Marat Mishnah, that this was essentially an exception. Remember what it said towards the end of the Mishnah when they came to Rabbi Gamliel and they said to him, Rabbi, they said, how come that you read Krishna the first night? So he said to them, you know, that, and you have taught us, incidentally, that the Mishnah says that a chasen is part of the first night. So he said to them, I refuse to let even one moment go by without feeling upon myself the O Malkut Shemayim, the yoke of the kingdom of heaven. But how many chasanim, you know, can reach the madrega of a Rabban Gamliel that they say at all times my mind is upon the Rebbeinu Shel Olam and so on, and whatever I'm doing it only to shame mitzvah, not to shame anything else, and so on and so forth. Since we cannot put ourselves on the same level, you see, so under those circumstances we say that a chasan has no right, you know, to claim that he is in the same spiritual level, you see, as Rabban Gamliel. Therefore, he should recite Krishna the first night. We'll see it as we go along with the Gemara. I mean, that this is essentially the reaction that we get from this. Okay. All right. Now, let's get on to the Gemara, which starts towards the end of the sixth line from the bottom. Tana Rabbanan. Now, they wanted to derive this. By the way, this has already been quoted before, several pages back, on Daf Yud Aleph. But this is the source, and Yud Aleph, they were quoting it. But here is the source where we find it in the Gemara. So this is what it says. our rabbis taught us, b'shivtecho b'veisecho, what does it mean when you dwell in your house, when you sit in your house? So he says, prot, this excludes, or this makes an exception in the case of the osik b'mitzvah, that if a person is involved in the performance of a mitzvah, then he is what? He's excused from reciting Kriya Shema. Otherwise, under all of the circumstances, While you're doing what you do normally, you should say Krishna. Okay. Uvalech techova derech. How do they imply this? Which means literally, of course, when you walk on the way or when you go on the way. So they say, makes an exception in the case of lechosan. In other words, that the chosan is excused on the basis of our interpretation of vavalech techova derech. So mikan, from this source, from this kind of midrash, as we would say, in other words, from this type of interpretation of what the pasuk says, so omru, therefore the sages said, hakone says hapsula potur, that one who marries a virgin is potur that first night, the eswal mono, but if he marries a widow, then chayef, he is obligated. My mashma, so the Gemara wants to know, how do you get this idea? So omra popo, Rav Papa said, it's ki derech. The because of a lech techova derech means that you have to compare it to a derech. What is a derech? Ma derech rishus. Just as derech, a way, a road, implies that you have, you know, the right to make a decision as to whether you want to walk on it, you don't want to take a walk on it, and so on and so forth. So, you're doing it, you know, for your own pleasure, for your own benefit, so to speak, right? So apocha nami rishus. So likewise over here, it is rishus. Well, this is not that clear as to what he means over there. So he says, b'loyaskin in the kozel v'dab mitzvah. Aren't we talking about where a person is going to perform a mitzvah? Va'afilu hochi omar rachmona v'krei. And nevertheless, the Torah says that you have to recite Krishna. Under what circumstances? It says what? Uvalech techova derech, right? Or b'shiruch techova v'sechot. In either case, it says that normally you recite, right? But uvalech techova derech, for example, if you have to go on the way for what? Not for your own pleasure, for your own benefit, but if you have to go on the way in order to fulfill a mitzvah, then in that case you are excuse from reciting Krishna. Milo askin in the kozel bar mitzvah. Aren't we talking about where a person is there to perform a mitzvah? A person goes to perform a mitzvah, filo hochi yomar achmuna v'ikre, and even so the Torah says that he should read Krishna. So they say in Cain, if this is what the interpretation is, then lemo kro beleches, then it should say simply beleches uvisheves. Beleches baderech uvisheves baderech. In other words, it means under all circumstances that you read, you're obligated to read Krishna, then it should say beleches baderech. My belech techor. Why does it say belech techor? So obviously this stresses upon what? Techor, which means your. So shma minor, from this we learn beleches didochu de bechayet. That if you're going around in order to do whatever you want to do, as we said before, your own rishus, in other words, what you feel like doing, then in that case, you are obligated to recite Krishna. But for the mitzvah, if you are involved in the performance of a mitzvah, which the Rabbeinu Shlomo said you should perform, then in that particular case, pitiras, you are potter from, reciting Krishna in the performance of this path. So, the Gemara asks, "Hey, Hochi, if that's the way you interpret it, so Ma'iri Hakonis is Absulo, Afilu Konis is Almona, Nami. Why do you say that only the person who marries a virgin is excused? Why? Because you say he's performing a mitzvah, and that's the reason why. So, if a person marries an Almona, it's also a mitzvah. Who says it's not a mitzvah? I mean, here's a poor almana, she needs a man to take care of her. So you're performing a mitzvah by marrying her too. So in that case, why do they say that if you marry the almana, that you have to recite Krishna? So they say, Hocha torid, v'hochale torid. So they say, okay, in the case of the man who marries a virgin, he is worried, he is concerned. What is he so concerned about? He's concerned about the fact, will he find, of course, his wife a virgin? And if she's not a virgin, then what is he going to do about it? Okay? So therefore, he's concerned. But hochaloi tarid, but in the case of a man who marries an almana, so he's not that concerned, because he knows he's not going to find virgin territory over there. So that's the reason why, since he's relieved of that particular worry, so therefore he doesn't have to recite Krishna. Well, they attack that too. So they say, Himishum Tirdov, this is the reason why he's excused from reciting it. Then in that particular case, anybody who is Torud, anybody who is concerned because things aren't going well, or he doesn't know how things are going to, you know, his mind is unsettled, in that case he should also be excused from reciting Krishna, right? And they give the case, Afilu Tova Svinosi Bayom Name, even if he had a ship in which he had invested, you know, his farmegans, right? He had invested his money either in the ship itself, he owned the ship, or maybe it was carrying stock, sure, which was going to come to him, or he had a share of it, you know, different things. And lo and behold, what happened to the ship? The ship sank, right? So, if he's concerned, you know, that his ship has sunk by yom into the ocean, so nami, then as long as there's the possibility that the ship is going to sink, he shouldn't have to say Krishna. If worry, concern is the only reason for excusing him from saying it. So they say, Aloma, why? Why, Umar Rabbi, Abba Varazafta, Umar Rav? So, therefore, we now come with the solution to the question. So, Rav Abba Varazafta said in the name of Rav, Abol Chaya Bechol HaMitzvah, it says, Obel Chaya Bechol Mitzvah Samuris Batorah, Chutz Benat Filin, Sha'arei Nema Behen Pe'er, Shenema Pe'er Chol Chavosh Olecha, etc. We go. Okay? Which means as follows. The objection now to the idea of tirdo, in other words, concern, worry, you feel blue, melancholy. Okay, this is what tirdo is, all right? Sure. In this particular, huh?
Stress,
very good. Okay, I mean, all these are good ways to describe what they mean by tirdo over here. So they quote as a counter argument the fact that we have a halacha which says that an ovel, a person who is in mourning, chayav b'chol mitzvos hamuros b'Torah, is required to perform all the mitzvos that the Torah has mentioned, chutz minat tefillin, except for putting on tefillin. Why not tefillin? Well, there we have a special case cited which tells us that the ovel does not wear it the first day. What is it? Sheharei ne'mar b'hen, because it is written concerning tefillin, pe'er. Pe'er means a diadem of glory. Okay? Diadem of glory. Pe'er, beauty and something. In other words, the tefillin are considered, when a Jew puts on tefillin, they are our diadem of glory, so to speak. Okay? And the prophet Yechezkel, as I had occasion to mention once before, not too many weeks ago, in the 24th chapter of Yechezkel, we read over there how a sudden tragedy came to the life of Yechezkel. Practically from the very beginning of the book, right until we reach chapter 24, we find that Yechezkel is full of denunciations of the sins of the people of Israel, and a prediction that the temple is going to be destroyed because of the sins of the people of Israel, and that this is the only way out for them, that this is the punishment that they deserve because of all the things that they had committed, idolatry and incest, or Gilearois, what we call incest. I don't mean necessarily brothers and sisters and so on, but I mean, like, for example, having relations with people who married to somebody else and so on and so forth. This is what I meant, what we had when we studied Kedushin, what we spoke about at that point, what are our royos and murder, in other words, the three cardinal sins which are mentioned in Sefer Vayikra. So Avodah Zorah, Yilui Arois, and Shvichas Damim. These three cardinal sins mentioned in Sefer Vayikra are also mentioned by Yechezkel, and he says that the people of Israel were guilty of all of these sins, and therefore they were going to be destroyed. So in other words, he is denunciatory in the first half of the book. There are 48 chapters, so 24 is really the dividing point. And all of a sudden, two things happen. Number one, his wife suddenly died. And secondly, a messenger comes to the Babylonian Golos, where Yechezkel was living, since the time that the Golos Yehoyachin had taken place. So if you remember historically, there were two Babylonian exiles. The first one happened in the year 597 before the common era. And then in the year 586 was the second one, in which the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. But at the time of the first Golos, when King Yehoyachin was taken into captivity and put into prison by the Babylonians, at that time they took thousands of Jews already, particularly from the upper classes and the skilled artisans and so on, to Babylonia's captive. And of course Yechezkel, being a Kohen, he was among those who were taken into Babylonian captivity. While behind, you see, the king of Babylonia, Nebuchadnezzar, appointed Zedekiyahu to be the king, but he made him swear that he would be loyal and never rebel against Babylonia. And of course, when Zedekiyahu rebelled, led on by false promises given by Egypt and what is today Syria, Iran, and so on and so forth, those nations, you know, that they said that they would come to the help of Israel in a rebellion against Babylonia, and then they left Israel stranded. So, you know, this was the end of the kingdom. At any rate, now the news came of the destruction of Jerusalem and the capture and the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash to Yechezkel. And as I say, it happened simultaneously with the fact that his wife suddenly passed away on. So the Rebbeinu Shel Olam said to Yechezkel, "Heyoneg dom, you have to bear your mourning in silence. Heercho lo sachvosh, do not put on this diadem upon your head." Or rather, he said to him just the opposite. He said to him, "Heercho chavosh, you put it on. You put on the tefillin, okay? And you should also keep your shoes on. You shouldn't tear your garments. You shouldn't put, sackcloth and ashes on." And why, George, Hawaii, why should Yechezkel be commanded by God to do these things which are counter to all the rules and regulations of Avelus, which were observed in those days, and, you know, most of which we observe to this very day, okay? But the answer is that the tragedy of the loss of the Beis HaMikdash and the destruction of Jerusalem was so tremendous that the ordinary rules of mourning would not apply. And this is what Yechezkel was given symbolically to understand. All right, now, from the things that Yechezkel was told that he should do, from this we know what the Ovel should not do. Okay, but the person in mourning should not do. So, if Yechezkel was told, you know, to put on tefillin, to put on the peir chol chavosh, then in that particular case, we learn that the ordinary ovel, however, does not put on tefillin. But when we discuss that further, you know, in the Gemara here and also in Moed Katan, particularly where the laws of Avelis are discussed in greater detail, so there we discover that this applies only to the first day of Avelis. When a person begins to sit shiva, let's say the funeral is taking place in the morning, the afternoon, wouldn't make any difference. But, okay, that morning, of course, before the burial takes place, he is in a state of what we call aninus. Aninus is a kind of mourning. We'll have further reference to it later on. Okay, it's a state of mourning wherein essentially the Onain has certain commandments from the Torah. All that it mentions, as we're going to discover, is that he's not allowed to eat matzah, not allowed to eat the tithing, okay? But in addition, our sages put in two further things that he's not permitted to do.
Prohibition.
Prohibitions, right, thank you. He's not allowed to eat meat and he's not allowed to drink wine during the time that he's in a state of uneasiness. Of course, both of them, you know, are symbols of the foods of joy, and since he's in a state which he's in mourning, but this stage has to be devoted particularly to doing what? The answer is to taking care of the dead. Preparing the dead for burial, as you know, through the Torah and everything else, and then, you know, carrying through to burial itself. This is the time when we have our needs. Okay. So an Onain does not wear tefillin. Alright, let's say the burial has then taken place. Let's say it's in the morning, okay? But it wouldn't make any difference what time of the day it is. But it's easier for us to see what I'm trying to bring out. If we would say, let's say the burial took place at 10 in the morning, okay? And they got back from the cemetery, let's say, at 11 o'clock, okay? Should he then put on tefillin because it's still morning? The answer is no. He's not allowed to wear it that first day. Not allowed to.
Assuming he was allowed to wear it, it's still past the time to put it on, isn't it?
No. To put it on until noon.
Well,
and when I say noon, I mean, you know, I mean the chatzos. I mean, if we go on daylight saving next week, that means it's more about 1 o'clock or so.
What if he
okay.
had davened in the morning? Mm-hmm.
If he had davened, he's excused from davening.
Okay.
As a nonin, he's excused. He's excused from all the mitzvos, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right. But that's an onin. Now, the burial has taken place. He is now no longer an Onain. What is he now? Now he's an Ovel. Okay? Now he's an Ovel. This is what we normally refer to when we speak about a mourner. You know that, for example, Kaddish should not be said until the actual burial has taken place. Okay? And at that particular point, this is when he begins to observe Avelis, such as, let's say, you know, to remove shoes. Okay? Such as, for example, not to go to work and things like that and so on. So, you know, all the laws, you know, of Avelis then take effect after the burial has taken place, okay? So as I said, all right, he comes home. All right? Should he put on tefillin? The answer is no. Because of this rule that we say that the first day, this Avelis is so... You know, it's the strongest point of Avelis, and therefore he's excused from wearing it. But should he observe the other mitzvahs? The answer is yes. For example, if he wants to daven, now he can daven. If he wants to bench, he can bench. You understand? That's what I'm saying. I mean, in other words, he observes all the other mitzvahs that the Torah itself specifies. Okay? Yes.
May a hain come to feeling, or is he just...
Yeah, well, he's patur. I mean, in other words, he's excused from it, but the point is he's expected not to put it on. Okay? This is part of the mourning, the fact that you're doing something which is unusual in order to express, you know, the depth of your mourning. But from that point on, as I said, I mean, for example, davening, you daven. I mean, you know, you try to make a minion in the house and so on, the other has to observe that.
Is that because it constitutes a symbolism of great joy?
The tefillin? Yeah, but beginning the second day, I mean, the following morning, he puts on already tefillin. Even though he's still in Ovel, right, but it's a special rule that concerns the first day, based upon this verse in Yechezkel. Okay? Alright, so, this is what we're saying right now, that we're making a general rule, and what is a general rule? That's mentioned, you know, in the name of Rav. It says, Ovel Chaya b'chol mitzvos v'amuros b'torah chuzkinat pita, right? That the person who is in mourning is now in Ovel, he is required to observe all the mitzvos mentioned in the Torah, except for putting on tefillin, and as I said, that's only the first day. Sha'arei ne'emar b'hen pe'er, because concerning them, we say that tefillin are like a diadem that we wear on our head. She'ne'emar pe'er for chavo shalecha, that Prophet Yechezkel was told, you put it on, and as I said, from the fact that the Rebbeinu Shel Olam said to him, you put it on, you must wear your tefillin, from this we learn that we must not wear tefillin when we are in mourning the first day. Okay? So, Amre, Hosam, Tirda Rishu, so they wind up by saying, okay, in the case of the mourner, the concern is still his own private concern. Whereas, Hocha, in the case of the Chosam, it's Tirda the Mitzvah. He still is concerned with performing of the Mitzvah, which is to begin establishing marital life with the wife. But as I said again, we'll discover later on that this business of being free from reciting Krishna, today we do not apply that when it comes to a chasam. Chasam is expected to recite Krishna the first night just as much as anyone else. All right. Now, since we spoke about Rabbi Gamliel, who said that he does not want for a minute even to be free of feeling the yoke of heaven, and therefore he performed an exceptional act in that the night that he got married he recited Krishna. So they bring a couple of other stories to show how Rabbi Gamliel felt that under certain circumstances you do opposite to what normally is thought. The next case that they bring is in the Mishnah, Rochatz Lailo HaRishon Shemesa Ishto. The first night that his wife had passed, he washed. So, first of all, we have to understand. I said that the ovel is required to observe certain things. Okay? Not only must he, you know, not wear shoes, but another one of the isurim, as we know, concerns what we call rechitza, washing. Ovel is not a permitted, you know, to wash anything other than just, you know, his hands, and maybe to get out the lifluf, you know, in other words, of his eyes or clogs, he's permitted to remove that, okay? And he's only allowed to use cold water. He's not allowed to wash in warm water, okay? This is a special sign of mourning and that, and of course, incidentally, you notice that some of these things that apply to the ovel during Shiva apply, interestingly enough, to the things that we are prohibited from doing on Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur. But there is a basic difference between Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur, even though the same rules apply. We're not allowed to have marital intercourse, right? Mm-hmm. We're not allowed to wash, not allowed to anoint ourselves, we're not allowed, you know, for example, to do laundry during this particular period, okay? But, and of course, on Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur, also you're not allowed to eat or to drink. These are some of the things, okay, that were prohibited. And yet, why is it prohibited on Tisha B'Av, and why is it prohibited on Yom Kippur? Is it for the same reason or not? The answer is no, it can't be for the same reason. Tisha B'Av we can understand. Tisha B'Av we are avelim, right? We are in mourning, and therefore we observe these things as part of the avelis. But on Yom Kippur, why do we observe these things? We observe it for a different reason. We observe it because we speak about the fact that this is a day upon which we have to afflict our souls. Ta'anu es nafsho sechem. The nisem es nafsho sechem. You have to afflict your souls. And since the word of affliction is mentioned five times in connection with Yom Kippur, you know, in various passages in the Torah, so from this we learn that there are five basic prohibited acts which happen to correspond to what I said before, but it is because we are afflicting our souls in order to purify ourselves so that we can ask God for forgiveness in our prayers. This is the basic difference between them. Tisha B'Av, it's avelis. But Yom Kippur, it's because we are afflicting ourselves so that we can purify ourselves and gain God's forgiveness. So, What did he do? Rabbi Gamliel, his wife passed away, and what did he do? He went and he washed. So Omer lo Talmidav, his disciple said to him, Dimaritonu Rabbeinu, our master, you taught us she'ovel osir lipots, that an ovel, person in mourning, is prohibited from bathing. It's not allowed to wash, prohibited from bathing. So Omer lahem, so he said to them, Eini kishor b'nei yodam, I'm not like the average person. Istanis ani, I am an istanis. Istanis means that I'm a very delicate person, and because I'm delicate, I actually feel pain if I don't wash. Of course, the question is, can we all claim that we're all istanis today or not? That's the question. But nevertheless, Rabbi Gamliel said it is for that reason. So we'll take a look at the Rashi for a moment, okay? All right. Let's start with the Rashi where it says Gemara over there, all right? First of all, Kotsovar Aninus Lailo Derabon. He thought that, you know, the fact that Aninus during the night is only prohibited by the rabbis. It's not a biblical prohibition. The Afal Pishoya Lael Yom, and even though it was the night of the day upon which his wife died, Yom Biso, Uchasiva Aninus Biraiso, Dixiv Lechalta Bioni Mimeni, and in the Torah they mention the fact of Aninus, as it is written, that the person who is eating Meister has to say, Lo Achalti Bioni Mimeno, I have not eaten from this, in other words, from the tithing, in my aninus, you know, when I was in deep mourning. Upochos miyom echot enu aninus. But less than one full day is not aninus. The Yalfe Rabbonin niva achrisok yomar. As the rabbis learn later on, that the Pasuk in Job says, and rather it's in Sinemus, that the end will be like a bitter day. So inasmuch as it says Yomar, a bitter day, the implication would be the entire day is that, but not the night. You understand? So Rabban Gamliel said, Ein Laila Shalacharov, that the night that follows this day, Im Hayom, to be considered together with the day. The day marks, you know, the day is the day, but come sunset, it's already not to be considered part of it, but it's already the next night. So he was no longer an oinin, okay? Elamid Rabbanan. This is only, you know, by the Rabbanan. So who kisha or yemeha evil? It's like other days of mourning. The Gabe Istanis, and as far as the business of Istanis, you know, delicate person is concerned, he says, Lo gozu bo Rabbanan, the Rabbanan did not prohibit it completely. There is a machlokes of Tanoim, you know, the early rabbis of the Mishnah in the Gemara of Zevachim, Aninus Lailo, concerning the Aninus at night, Imid Oraiso, Imid Rabbanan, whether this Aninus is to be considered Torah commanded or Mid Rabbanan. Now let's take a look at Tosfos, right opposite over there. Istanis ani, the ikotzar, and the Tosfos adds that there is pain im lo hayarochets. He would feel pained if he didn't wash. The eino osi lichotz me evlo el mishum tanik. Why? What is the reason why we are prohibited from washing, from bathing during the days of our mourning? The answer is mishum tanik, because we enjoy the feeling of being clean, and since this gives us pleasure, so this is the reason why they prohibit it. The gam lechofro, showing the same thing about shampooing the hair. E isle irbuvio bereshe shori. If you have an irbuvio, which means a holy mess in your hair, then it is permitted. If you have lice fighting around or something like that, then in that case, you are permitted to shampoo it. Afilu tok Shiva, even during the days of Shiva. V'chein hiter Rabbeinu Shmuel liyoledes. And so Rabbeinu Shmuel also permitted a woman who had just given birth and avela, she was in mourning, lichotz toch shiva, that he permitted her to wash during these days of shiva, lichotz namei b'tisha b'av, and also he gave permission that she should be permitted to wash on tisha b'av. V'chein mashma namei maseches yumo. And likewise, we learn from the Gemara in Yumo, which deals primarily with Yom Kippur, which says, "Mi sheyesh lo chatotim b'rosho," if somebody has boils in his head or lice in his head, soch kedarka b'yom kippur, then he's permitted to anoint it as he normally would, even on Yom Kippur. We said before that sicha, anointing, is one of the things that's prohibited. But what kind of sicha are we talking about? In other words, we're talking about sicha shaltana, where we get pleasure out of, you know, shampooing or anointing ourselves and so on. But if it is because we have a medical problem that's driving us nuts, then in that particular case, it's permitted. The Yeno Choshesh, and you know, we don't have to worry about this particular action, Afal Gav, even though the Sicha Keshasiyo B'Yom HaKippurim, that Sicha is just as prohibited as drinking on Yom Kippur. V'chein Mashba B'Yerushalmi, likewise, the Gemara Yerushalmi also says, Ovel Oso B'Yerchitza, right, that the Ovel is prohibited from washing, Ador the Tema B'Yerchitza Sheltanik. By that we mean specifically rechitza shel tanug, where we're doing it for pleasure. Avol birechitza sheino shel tanug mutar. But when it comes to washing, which is not for joy, then it's permissible. Kehado de itnar, as we have just learned, mishiyesh lechatot bereisha. So we see then that Rabbi Gamliel, even though an ovel is not permitted to do, and the sages said to his disciples, after all, they're all Talmidei Chachamim, they said to him, "You taught us that it's prohibited." But he said, "Look, there are exceptions. The exception is if you are an istemis, if you feel actual pain and not pain." So this is another exceptional case. All right. Next, Shemes Tabi, when Tabi Abdo, his slave, died, kibel alav tanchumim. So he accepted condolences for the death of Tabi. Omer lo talmidav, so his disciples said to him, "Nibaritonu Rabbeinu, you taught us, our teacher, she'im ekabim tanchumim avod, that if your slaves die, you don't accept condolences, you know, you don't expect people to give you the same type of condolences that they give, you know, to a person, you know, who's not a slave." So Omalahem, so he said to them, "Ain Tabi Abdi Kishor Kol Havodim. Tabi, my slave, was not like all the other slaves. Kosher Hoya. He was a kosher person." In other words, he was an outstanding human being. And as a result, I feel the loss just as if he were what? A member of my family. That's how I feel about it. So, as we see, in all of these cases, Rabbi Gamliel said that the reason why there are exceptions, and he explained his exception, and of course, incidentally, concerning Tabi, there are many, many stories told, because he was a great sage, very clever. He knew his halachas very well. As a matter of fact, if he weren't a slave, he probably could have become a rabbi. Of course, today rabbis become slaves, but Tabi the slave could not become a rabbi. Why not? Because the slave, if you remember, the yevid, or the shivka, the woman slave, right, has a special status in Jewish law. As we saw, it was inferior to that of the kind of Levi in Israel. It's already an inferior. And of course, in Gemara and Kedushin, if you remember, we had the problem, you know, a slave cannot marry a freeborn Jewish woman. He can marry another slave woman, so, but he cannot marry a freeborn. Or he could marry a Gioris, you know, a woman who had converted to Judaism. But he could not marry, you know, someone who was born Jewish. Of course, we don't have slaves today, so that the whole thing is academic. But in those days, 2,000 years ago, it was still an institution, and they're still there. But Tavi is mentioned many, many times in the Mishnah and Gemara, you know, for his unusual wisdom and everything else. And Rabban Gamliel wanted to free him. But an Eved Kanani, there's a pasuk in the Torah which says that they are to serve you le'olam, forever. So under those circumstances, it's considered that an Eved Kanani, by the way, what happens with an Eved Kanani, we've already spoken. He said that if you take a slave, so the first thing that you have to do, you have to circumcise him, you have to, you know, immerse him in the mikveh. And he is a Jew for all purposes, except that he's excused from certain things. This is why they always say, you know, chutz mei, right? Eved, etc., koton, and so on, you know. So therefore he's excused from what? From the mitzvahs atzei shez ban groma. From, you know, positive, affirmative commandments that a woman also is excused from, because they are dependent upon time. But he is a Jew, you see. So Tavi was a Jew, but because he was an Eved Kanani, in other words, he was born as a non-Jew, so that therefore Rabban Gamliel could not legally free him. But I have to tell you that the Torah does have times when they see that an Eved Kanani can be freed. Specifically, the Torah says that if you injure an Eved, right, you injure him, let's say you knock off his nose, or you poke his eye out, or you deafen him in the ear, whatever it may be, any part of the body that we consider as Rosh Yavorim, in other words, parts of the body that stick out in one form or another, or let's say you lock off a finger or something like that, you understand? Then in that case, automatically, he gains his freedom. So, but, you know, you wouldn't imagine that Rabban Gamliel would treat his slave that way. So that this is why he could not, you see, become a rabbi or gain his freedom. But he was so close to him, and everybody admired him so, that even though legally they should not have given the ordinary words of consolation to Rabban Gamliel that you would give to, you know, let's say if a member of Rabban Gamliel's family had passed away, here Rabban Gamliel said he was kosher, he was a very good person, and he deserves, you know, that he should be considered like any other person who's lost, you know, as if he were a member of my family who's lost, I feel so deeply.
He was a Jew, but he could not marry.
He could marry another, he could marry a shifra, that he could do. Yeah, that he could do. Or, as I say, he could marry also a Gioris, a woman who had converted to Judaism. He's permitted to marry her. But the Eved could not marry someone who was considered, you know, a Jew, a pure Jew by birth, okay? It's one of these rules, that's all. And likewise, the same rule would apply to the shifka, to the maidservant, which really means woman slave in this particular case. She also could not marry a Yisrael, you see, for the same person, same reason.
Wasn't it, I remember Kedushin, especially in the district of Yehuda.
Yeah, well, not in Yehuda, but there were areas where they were suspicious about, you know, whether they were that observant about these things, correct. They were also questioning about whether the Kahanim really, you know, were that careful about their own yichus and so on and so forth. That's true. This is what we did learn.
Correct.
Yeah.
Basically, there's a matter of fact, they even use this expression of someone being engaged as being the expression of vowing the shifa because Adon, a master,
yeah,
the Yehudi, could marry the shifa, correct?
Wrong.
Not correct.
The only thing, the only one that he could marry is what we would call a
Oma Ivriya?
No, a Katana. Yeah, the Oma Ivriya, correct. The Oma Ivriya is not the same as the Shifa Katanas. They're two different categories we're talking about.
So I should not marry a Shifa at all?
No.
Ever?
No. That he couldn't do. But they could still get married, you know, to one of their own group, their own class, and, you know, live a normal family life too, you see. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, but there is a difference between the law concerning the Yom HaIvriyah as compared to the Shifa, even though we translate both of them in English because we don't have the adequate words for it, you know. These are technical expressions, okay? And therefore the Yom HaIvriyah, she is a young girl, the father is sold, and the Torah says, you know, that there are two things that could be done. Either the master could marry her, or if he wants, he could decide, you know, that his son could marry her, or if he refuses to do so, then the minute that she shows signs of puberty, at that particular point she gains her freedom, and, you know, she doesn't have to pay the master in order to gain her freedom. So that this is what we learned. And of course, I mean, she is entitled also, you know, to all the things that happen, all the severance pay, so to speak, you know, that the master has to give to the Eved or to the Omo Ivriya, in that, you know, he has to make sure that they have plenty to take with them and to compensate them for the time, etc., etc., etc. So that the Torah is very generous, you know, in deciding, you know, what you have to do at the time when they have completed the amount of time that they're supposed to serve. Yeah. Okay. Now, let us continue over here then. Okay. Now the Mishnah continues and it goes back again to what we said about the Chosan. Chosanim rotzeh likros kriya shma laila rishon korei. Now the Mishnah says that what if the chassan decides that he wants to read Krishna the first night of his marriage? So he reads. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Omer, Rabbi Shimon, the son of Gamliel, says, Lo kol harotze litol es Hashem yitol. Not everybody who wants to take this title as being, you know, so super concerned with the Ol Malchus Shemayim has the right to do so. In other words, it is considered presumptuous on the part of a person to say, I am so holy, I'm so involved in my desire to perform the mitzvah that a chassan has to perform on the marital night, that I am excused from saying Krishna. He says, no, not everybody. Not only does the Mishnah say that if the person wants to, he can, but he says, go you one better. Not everybody who thinks that they are in the same category as Rabban Gamliel is really in the same category. All right. Now, my Tama the Rabbanon, the Rabban Gamliel, what is the reason for Rabban Gamliel, why he said so? It's because of Aninus Lilo the Rabbanon, because he was of the opinion that Aninus at night is only rabbinically ordained, not by the Torah, and Ditziv, as it is written, Yachriso Kiyomar, that the end is a bitter day. In other words, when death occurs, it is a bitter day, right? But not, what? Not the following night. It doesn't apply anymore to that. It's only during the day. Uvimikom istanis that goes to Beirabonim. And in the case of a person being an istanis, then the prohibition washing that night, this did not apply. The Rabbanan did not make a gezeirah, they didn't make a decree against it. as we've already seen from Tosfos, you know, that it depends. Not everybody is an Istanis, but on the other hand, if you are, if you need it for hygienic purposes because you're suffering from a malady, whatever it may be, then in that particular case, and as I say, you're not washing because you enjoy the washing, but you're doing it only in order to take care of some medical condition that you have, then in that particular case, it is permitted. All right, now they go back again to where the Mishnah says, Uch Shemes Tabi Abdo. Tan Rabba, our sages taught, Avodah Mishvachos, male slaves, female slaves, in Omdim Aleihem Vishura. You do not stand in rows for them, V'yein Omrim Aleihem Birkas Aveilim, nor do you recite for them the blessing of the mourners, V'tanchumei Aveilim, nor do you recite the traditional words of condolences to the mourners. Alright, let's explain each of these. Standing in the row. Originally, as Rashi sees it, it meant that as a person, let's say, came back from the cemetery, right? So people would stand outside the house, stand in a double row, and the mourners would file through, and at that time, you know, they would offer words of consolation to them. Today, of course, our practice is to do it at the cemetery immediately after the burial, when we ask everybody to form a double line so that the mourners could pass through, and then we say the traditional words of Tanchumim. What are the words of consolation, which would be, you know, the last thing that's mentioned over here? The answer is Hamokim Yenachem Eschem, or whatever it may be, right? These are the traditional words of comfort that we say, although in the time of the Talmud, people were a little bit freer in some of the expressions that they used. But this is what we say today. All right. Now the question is, what is the other thing that they mentioned, namely Birkat Avelim, the blessing of the Avelim? Rashi explains it on the basis that by Birkat Avelim, he's referring to what we call the Seudas Havroah. What is the Seudas Havroah? When the mourners return home from the burial, the first meal may not be prepared by them. Instead, the first meal has to be prepared by others. Okay? Some people think that it applies to all the days of Shiva. It's not true. It's only the first meal that is the Seudas Havroah. But, you know, when it comes to mourning, Seudat Havra'ah. Hey, Beis, Reish, Aleph, Hey. Havra'ah. No. Havra'ah is from the word Lamavri, Havri, which means literally to heal. In other words, Seudas Havra'ah, this is the meal which is being offered in order to give some healing to the mourners in their consolation. You know the word Bari?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, all right. Bari means healthy, right? So the Havri is used technically over here to refer to this particular meal that you serve the mourners when they come home from the from the burial. Okay? Now, our benchers don't have it. Most Siddurim today don't have it. But if you had an old, really complete Siddur, you'll see that when it comes to the benching, there is a different nusach that you use in the house of mourning. And particularly true at the Seudas Havroah. The nusach affects both the third bracha and the fourth bracha. Of course, the third bracha, you know, Rachem Arashem Elokeinu Yisrael Amecha, and so on. So the bracha, instead of ending, you know, Baruch Ato Hashem Bonei Barachmo Yerushalayim, right? It ends instead of, you know, Bonei Barachmo Yerushalayim Nachem Avelim, or something like that. I forget already. I would have to look it up myself in one of my old Siddurim that I have in the house, you know, one of the more complete Siddurim, where they have the benching mentioned. Today you don't find it in the Siddurim. People have forgotten that there is such a thing. But where you have a complete Siddur, one that has every possible occasion or something like that, then you'll find that. And then the next one, you know, the Brach of Hatova Ameitiv has, in addition to the general theme, you know, that God does good unto us, but it also says, "Yigdor mi'aleinu pirtzazos." May God heal this great breach, this great
tragedy that has befallen unto us. So that this is included in that. If I had remembered, if I weren't in such a rush to get down over here, I would have looked for one of my old siddurim so I could show you the exact nusach, because we don't have any siddur over here on the premises which has that particular nusach. But for centuries, this was the special bracha which was added in the house of mourning, and as I said, particularly for the Suddhas HaBrach. Somebody recites these brachas in order to ask God to send consolation to the mourners. So, according to Rashi, then the Birkas Avelim that we're talking about over here, the bracha for the mourners, this is what we are referring to at this particular point. Alright, so what are we saying over here? We're saying that if a slave dies, male or female, then the usual forms of Avelis are not carried on as far as the master is concerned. In other words, we don't stand in a double row, nor do we recite the special bracha, the Birkas Avelim, right? Nor do we say the traditional words of Hamokim Yenachem Eschem that we would normally say to the mourners. Masa, yes.
Well, now, does this also apply to a toshav?
Well, what do you mean by a toshav right now?
Okay, Abed Ivri.
An Abed Ivri?
Okay.
The Abed Ivri is a Jew for all purposes. Only during the time that he is a slave, you know, so that is, he has to devote himself to working for his master. And therefore, the same rules that we said concerning before, you know, that he's part of a certain mitzvahs, this applies to the Abed Ivri. Okay? But he was born a Jew, and the minute that he attains his freedom, he's a Jew again. I mean, 100%, you know, with all his rights restored, so to speak. Okay, that's what I mean. Okay?
Well, my question is,
yeah.
Let's say he's Abed Nirtza, alright?
An Abed Nirtza, yeah.
Okay. And he dies.
That's somebody who has decided he wants to be a slave forever.
Right.
Okay?
And he dies.
Yeah.
Even the young ones died.
Yeah.
Now, what is the halakha? What was the halakha?
Well, then the halakha would probably follow the fact, you know, that as long as he preferred slavery to freedom, then let him be treated as a slave. What am I going to tell you? I mean, the Torah doesn't want people to remain slaves. You know that. I mean, when it comes to, you know, towards the end of Vayikra, you know, Sedra Bahar, where we read Kili Bnei Yisrael Avodim, because the people of Israel are my servants, right? Avodaihem, they are mine. So you know what the sages say. The sages say, you know, that it means that we are to be the servants of God, but not to be the servants of other human beings. In other words, we are not to be enslaved to others. A person who purposely chooses slavery over freedom, he's denying one of the great teachings of the Torah itself. I mean, because the Torah wants us to be free so that we can serve God, you see. This is the idea. But not to be the slaves of other human beings. Alright, at any rate, we don't have slavery today. We have other forms, but I mean, officially, we don't have an evident mission for anymore. So that these rules would not apply, but you know, we learn Torah because, as they say, drosh v'kabel schar, we have to learn and receive the reward for the learning, because we have to know. It's part of Torah learning too, you see, even though it may not be applicable today, but nevertheless it's a mitzvah to learn too. Alright, let us continue right now. So now Masa Mesa Shev Chosel Shev Rabbi Eliezer, another story. This time it's not about Rabbi Gamliel, but it's about Rabbi Eliezer. His slave woman passed away. She died. Nichtasu Talmidov the Nachma. His pupils came in order to offer him the regular consolation. Kevan Shorosom, as soon as he saw them, Ololalios, so he ran up to the attic. The Yolo Acharov, so they ran up after him. Nichtasulan Pilon, so then he ran down and he went to a little house which is at the gate. This is how they understand the word on pylon. Pylon, you know the word pylon in Greek.
So the pilon is a place which is right next to the gate. That's what the word pilon originally means in Greek. So he went to the gatehouse, okay? Came to the gatehouse, nichtasu achro, so they came after him. Nichtas the traklik, the traklin. So then he went into the parlor. Nichtasu achro, so they ran in after him. Omalahem, so he said to them, kimiduma ani. It seems to me, shatem nichim beposhrim, achshavi atem nichim afilu bechamim chamim. He says, seems to me, he says, that you are not only being burned by lukewarm water, which is what poshrim is, but you're even being burned by the hottest type of water. What he wants, of course, what he's trying to say to them is, it seems to me that you are doing absolutely the wrong thing and you don't realize what you're doing. Lo kach shanisi lachem, didn't I teach you? Avodim u'shvochos enonim aleihem b'shurov enonim aleihem birkas avelim u'tantmei avelim. Didn't I teach you that when it comes to male slaves, female slaves, when they die, that you don't stand in the double row, you don't say the bracha for the mourners, you don't express the traditional words of consolation? So what do you do? Elama omrim aleihem. What do you have to say, you know, to the master about the fact that his slave, or you know, the slave male of whom has died? So he says, kashem shomim lo la'odem asheracham oro shemesu. So he says, just as you would say to a person who has lost his ox or his donkey, they died. So you say to them, hamokom yemale lecho chesroncho. May God take care of your loss and repay you. In other words, that may you, you know, may God make up to you for your loss. So kachom bimalavdu v'shal shivchoso. So likewise, this is what you're supposed to say when a male slave or a female slave dies. You have to say habokim yimali lechoches roncha. Say to the master, may God make up unto you the loss that you have suffered. Tanya Yidach, there's another version of this, which says, Avodim Ishvachos Eimatzpidin Otzon, that when a male slave or a female slave dies, you don't have a hesped for them. In other words, you don't have a formal eulogy for them. Rabbi Yossi Omer, Rabbi Yossi says, Im Eved Koshehu, however, if he was, you know, a very, very good and kosher soul, then Omrim Alav, then what do they say about him? They say, Hoy Ish Tov V'Ne'eman. Ah, what a good and faithful person he was. V'Ne'eh Mi'Yigiyo. And he enjoyed his hard work. In other words, he was satisfied to work hard and to earn his living that way. So Omru Lo said, they said to him, Him came my knuckle at share. If this is the kind of a eulogy that you say for a slave, what should we say about people who are not slaves? The average person, isn't this a beautiful eulogy to give them? So there's nothing really, not to distinguish one from the other. If you say, Ish Tov V'Ne'eman, he was a good man, he was a faithful man, he worked hard all his life and so on. This is the kind of things that we say, you know, in our eulogies concerning whoever they be. So... Okay, Tana Rabbah, our sages have learned, Ein Koren Ovos Ela L'Shloisha V'Ein Koren Imohos Ela L'Yarba. Only three people are called Ovos, literally fathers, right? And only four people are called Imohos, mothers. Ovos, Maitama. Why, in the case of course, you know who I mean by the three and the four. The three, of course, Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, and the four are so Rifka, Rocha, and Leah. Okay. So, my Tama, Ovos, my Tama, what is the reason about Ovos? Ilaymor, if you are to say it's Mishum Dol Yadinon, Imeruvin Karsinon, Imishimin Karsinon, if you want to say it's because we don't know essentially who our father is. Was it Ruvain or was it Shimon? We don't know what tribe we came from, and so on. So, therefore, we don't use the word Ovos in referring, let's say, to the children of Yaakov. Yaakov, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, they are Ovos. But once you come to the children, we don't know from which tribe we come.
So it's not proper to use the word obos. Ihochi, in that case, himois dami lo yadina. Then in that case, we don't know either which mothers we come from. I merochel koatsinin, I meleo koatsinin, whether we come from Rochel or Leo, right? We don't know from where we come. So that cannot be the reason, because we don't know. That's not the reason why we say there are only three ovos and only four imohos. Elad hocha chashive, tfele chashive. But the reason is, who are considered the three fathers par excellence? The answer is Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. From that point on, we don't say that they are the fathers par excellence. They're our ancestors, but only Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob have that particular status of being. And the same thing, of course, is true as far as the the mothers are concerned, the imohus as well. Tanya Idoch, another teaching concerning, you know, the business about male slaves, female slaves. It says, "En koren osam abba ploni ve'imo ploni." We do not refer to them as abba ploni, father ploni, or mother ploni. Apparently, as Rashi says, just as today we say mar, moras, in other words, Mr. So-and-so, Mrs. So-and-so, so in those days they used the word abba and imo in reference, you know, to this one and that one, okay? So he says over here that if it's a slave, don't use the term abba and imo in referring to them. Maselistor, so he says, what are you trying to do? You're trying to knock down what we've said before? Is that why I'm mentioning this? But Bishum the Chashive, the reason why we say that there are only three fathers and four mothers is not because we're trying to knock down their ancestry to say that this one is a father and this one is not a father, this one is a mother and so on, but because they are the most important. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they're the most important fathers, and so Rivka, Rachel, and Leah, they're the most important mothers, and this is the reason why. Okay, so I think we'll stop at this point. It's close to 9 o'clock. Next week, Ibyas Hashem, we have some very, very beautiful material to read, and I think we'll also be able to finish the second parak next week, because it's we're going to learn next week particularly private prayers that some of the great rabbis would utter after they finished reciting the Shemona Esrei, and we'll save those goodies for next week. But I also want to point out that, you know, we're going on daylight saving time next week. Therefore, we'll daven next week at 7 o'clock, and we'll have our shiur right after the davening at approximately 7:30. Okay? Okay. We are... Okay, you see where Rashi ends over there? Okay, good. So, parallel with that, okay? Count. One, two, three, four lines up from there. Well, actually, yeah. Okay, Omar Rabbi Eliezer, it says up there, okay?
Omar Rabbi Eliezer, right.
Right, okay. We, of course, have been talking about the importance of Krishma, Shemona Esrei, and so Rabbi Eliezer comes in right now with an interpretation to show again how important the recital of Krishma and Shemona Esrei is, and then he comes in, and then we're going to start a whole series of very, very beautiful private prayers, about which I'll have something to say just in a few moments. Okay. Anyway, on the Rabbi Elazar, is it working? Yeah. Yes. Rabbi Elazar said, "My desiv." What is the meaning of the pasuk when it says, "Kein avorechecho bechayai"? So will I praise you during my lifetime. Bishimcho esor kapai. And in your name will I raise my hands. Obviously, it means I will raise my hands in prayer. All right. So he says, "Kein avarechecho bechayai." So shall I bless you in my during my lifetime? Zu kriyashma. In other words, I'll recite Krishma the days of my life. Bishimcha esor kapai. And in your name will I raise my hands. You know. So this, of course, zu tefila. This is the Shemona Esrei. Remember again that when tefila is mentioned, usually they refer to the Shemona Esrei.
No,
Shemona Esrei. Tefila normally means Shemona Esrei. Right.
So, the Yim Oise Kain, and if he does so, in other words, if throughout his lifetime he says Krishma and he daven Shmonesra, so all of Akosav Omer, then concerning him, the Pasuk continues and it says, it's the same capital, you see, it's the same parak of Tehillim, it says, Kamo Chedo Vadeshin Tispanavshi, says, then, just like chalev, which is fat, and deshen is like the marrow of the bone, so like fat and marrow, in other words, all good things, tispa nafshi.
Is it ashes?
Huh?
Is it ashes?
No. No, you're not wrong.
Okay,
you're not
yeah.
wrong. I'll come back to that in 1 second.
Chalev is wax?
We translate it as wax today, but in reality, chalev is really fat.
Fat.
Right.
Yeah,
okay. Come back to all these technical questions. 1 second, okay?
Okay.
Anyway, my soul will be sated, you know, will be filled to satiety, right? With what? You know, with the joy of saying Krishna and davening Shmones, right, with Krishna and Tfila. Just as I am satisfied when I eat a beautiful piece of fat and the marrow. No, I don't have to tell you, number one, this is long before cholesterol was ever invented.
And they had long-lived people.
Of course they did. Listen, I remember, I mean, when I see this, I have a vision in front of me.
Do we have a theorist from the Rambam on this?
No.
You would have seen what he would have been.
Right. Yeah. I have a vision of my father, Rav Shalom. Needless to say, what meat was considered the most delicious? It was the meat which had fat. We know that, right? Right. And as far as marrow is concerned, I remember how my father used to love to shmokshin the bainer, as they used to say.
Sure. I still do that.
Yeah.
I still do that.
Okay.
Look for it.
Right. So this is the greatest delight, you know, when it comes to eating. So likewise, our soul also enjoys reciting Krishna and Shmonesra. This is how he touches the Pasuk. And as I said, it's all from the same capital Tehillim. Well, not only that, but if you do, in other words, if you say Krishna religiously, and you daven, you say Shmonesra religiously, you know, all the days of your life, then you know what the reward is going to be? The reward will be, not only that, he is going to inherit both worlds, so Elam Hazeb, Elam Haba, both this world and the world to come, Shinemar, as it is written, and then this is a continuation of the Pasuk, which says, Lusfosai, and my lips, Renonos songs Yehalel Pi. My mouth will praise you with songs. Now, how do we get the fact that you get to Elamis? So, of course, Rashi explains. All right, let's take a look for a second at Rashi. It says, Kena Barechecho, so will I praise you. He says, Ochemo Chelev Edeshen. And he says, Trei Kroy Desbichel Adodi. First of all, he explains that these two psukim are right next to each other in Tehillim, and then what is Renonos? Why songs? Songs implies, says Rashi, Shtayim. In other words, twice. So that's from the fact that the word Renonos is written in the plural, so from this we understand that we will sing God's praises in this world, and we will also sing praises to Him in the world to come. This is how Rabbi Elazar teaches this particular group of psukim from Tehillim. Okay, you asked me before about chalev, and you asked me about deshen, okay? So let us take the word chalev first of all. Chalev, of course, means fat, okay?
That's literally.
The truth of the matter, literally, this is what it means, okay? Now, in reality, a Jew is not supposed to eat chalev, so he's only using the word chalev over here. Shall I say poetically? Okay, after all, David HaMelech, after all, he was a poet, okay? So that he's using the word poetically, because technically, we make a distinction between chelev and shuman, right? Shuman being the permitted fat in the animal,
and
chelev being the non permitted to us. But why is it non permitted? It's non permitted to us because the Torah says that originally the chelev and the dumb, they were part of the sacrifices, and those were the parts, you see, that were
burnt.
In the case of the chalav, it was burnt on the altar, and of course the dumb sprinkled upon the altar, so that this was considered, so to speak, sort of like the choicest part of the animal that was being sacrificed. So that we see now, I mean, why he uses the word chalav, not because he's talking about whether we can eat it or not, but simply, you know, to indicate that this is choice, you see. Okay, now as far as what you said about ashes, okay?
Yeah, Deshen was also...
Yeah, well, right, partial, absolutely,
you know,
right. As a matter of fact, this is what we're going to be reading this week,
right,
in the Torah, the very
right.
first verse, right? Savis Aaron is beloved Emor, right? To command Aaron and his son, saying, Zos Tarasu law, and so on, that this is the law of the burnt offering, which is offered up all night long, and so on and so forth, Lamoto, in the place where it has to be burned. V'yesh ha-mizbeach tukadbo, and the fire of the mizbeach has to be kindled actually with this. And then it's written, V'lovash ha-kohen midavad, and then the Kohen has to put on linen garments. V'hotzi'ez ha-deshen, and the chustamachnen, he has to take the ashes, but it's not just ashes, it's the ashes which of course has been mixed in with the fat of the animal. So that this is why they use the term deshen in that.
So what does it mean now if it's not ashes? What does it mean? What is the
here it simply means like the marrow or you know,
marrow.
Right,
the marrow.
No, the marrow of the bone, the deshen.
Okay.
But literally the word deshen means ashes.
That's right. That's
literally
the basic meaning, but not only, but not the only meaning.
Yeah.
It could also be simply a synonym for fatness, for marrow. And I want to point out, I mean, we say it every single Friday and Shabbos, right? Oh, you know them to save up. They shall still bear fruit in old age, right? The shenim ra'ananim yiyu. Now, what does it mean, the shenim? It means that we will be full of fat. In other words, we won't wither away, right? Ra'ananim, and will be ever fresh
for you.
Right, I mean, the righteous will always be fresh, and you know, they will not wither and so on and so forth. And this is really what David HaMelech is talking about when he uses that phrase. So so much for the meaning of the words.
Right.
But as you can see, words are susceptible in Hebrew to various interpretations. This is why in one context it can mean this, in a different context it can mean something else, but still, usually there's some sort of a thread which runs between one meaning and the other. Although at times we can't always see the thread, but nevertheless there usually is something that connects one of the meanings with another one of the meanings. Okay, now we come to a very, very beautiful passage, and I just want to say one word. We're talking about the beauty of reciting Krishma and Shemoneh Esrei and so on. Now, in Shemoneh Esrei, of course, we know that the nusach, in other words, the formulation of how the prayers should be, I mean, this is pretty much fixed.
Nusach is not humility, it's the formulation.
Right. The first idea of nusach is the formulation. What is the wording? That's the second meaning of the word. You see, I'm telling you.
About the meaning.
Yeah.
Words are susceptible to different meanings depending upon their context. Yeah. Yeah, that's a tune, right. Although actually today in Israel they also use the word lachan for a tune, something like
lachan.
That. Lachan, yeah. The word is found also, yeah. But mangino, yeah, that's song playing, actually it's, you know, melody that you play, that's mangina, the word the nagin to play, right,
taking the melodic version,
correct, right. But when we talk about nusach, we mean first of all the formulation of the prayers, in other words that the formulation of the brachas of the Shemoneh Esrei, this already dates back to the days of the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, in other words it goes back approximately 2,500 years. Later on, when we get into the beginning of the fourth chapter, we'll learn that there's also a theory that, you know, one of the sages of Talmud says that actually Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov already, they were davening Shemoneh Esrei, so to speak. Each one formulated a different prayer. Abraham was the one who ordained that we should say Shachris, and Yitzchak to David Mincha, and Yaakov to David Maariv. Okay?
But nevertheless, the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah came and they formulated how we should say. Okay? Then, of course, as a subsidiary idea to this, we have the idea that you have a Nusach Ashkenaz, you have a Nusach Sfard, you have Nusach Hari. In other words, the wording of the Shmon Esser will have some slight variations, and sometimes the order, and the Shmon Esser, it's not a question of the order, but for example, in other parts of the service, there may be some differences in the order. One of course the classic cases is, should we say Baruch Shayoma before Hoidi? or should we say Hoidi before Baruch Shayoma? Okay.
What kind of pronunciation is that?
That's the way the Gamsiana pronounces
it. I see, okay.
So, that's the difference, one of the differences between Nusach Ashkenaz and Nusach Sfard. But if you would compare, for example, the Nusach Sfard Seder, and by the way, when I say Nusach Sfard, I don't mean Spanish Portuguese. That's real Nusach Sfard, okay? What we call Nusach Sfard is really
what
the Hasidim done, okay? Which is really Nusach Ashkenaz with some variations to it, okay? Anyway, if you put the two together, so you see that in some of the brachas they've added a phrase here, added a phrase there, word over here, word over there, or something like that. But in general, you see, we are saying the same prayers. So in this case, we don't say that, that they simply came along and invented something of their own. Simply that there was a tradition among the Ashkenazim to say the Shmon Esrei using this formulation, right? The Sfardim came along and they had their own, okay? Spanish Portuguese, the Jews of the Orient, they all have their own versions. If you would go to Eretz Yisrael, for example, you go to the Kotel and you'll see that there is a variety of Siddurim over there on the tables that they have over there, because, Jews from the entire world come to Daven over there, and each one has his own Nusach. So this is the first meaning then of the word Nusach, that Nusach HaTfilah refers to how do you say the prayers, what is the formulation of the davening, in what order are the prayers said, and so on, and the differences represent, as I say, the differences in tradition between them. Okay. Then, of course, then you're right that the word Nusach then acquired a second meaning, and that is, how do we chant the prayers that we say? Those of us who have been brought up, of course, in Nusach Ashkenaz, know that there's a difference in melody that we use for the weekday as compared to Shabbos, and that when it comes to what melody do we use for Shmon Esrei, so this is going to vary, of course, according to, is it the Shmon Esrei of Shacharis of Musaf, is it the Shmon Esrei of Mincha, and so on, you see, so that the melodies differ. And in order to be a chasen, or even in order to be a good Baal Tefillah, you have to know what are the correct melodies in order to set the mood for that particular service.
David? My daughter's heritage, there, if you watch the history, all the Morim are now Taimanim.
Right, they are.
Gal Saidi and Gil Abraham.
Right.
So one day I was listening to my daughter do Shachri.
Yeah.
And I forget exactly what she was doing, but she starts, Haftarabba. She starts coming out. She actually sounds like a Taimani, exactly the
like
way
what?
Like a Yemenite. Like the wayal and
Northerners.
I wouldn't know it.
Yeah. Very good teacher. Excellent. Very, very good. They're all. Well, anyhow, I'm sorry. I was just saying about the melody.
Avrahami, if you remember, he was here for a morning. He gave him the Aliyah, so he gave us a rendition ala Taimani. Remember, it was hard to recognize.
Oh, he read it from the Torah, if I remember.
Right, he had the total deal over there.
Yes, I remember hearing it. It's a different kind of...
Different than pronunciation.
It's more of a monotone than anything. Yeah. It's more of a monotone, yes.
And also, you know, the pronunciation is different from that.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
When he speaks Hebrew, he speaks like all the Israelis do.
Right.
But in this particular case, when he was reading from the Torah, naturally he was doing, you know, his thing.
I've heard that from two other also Oriental Jews. The way that same way. Mm-hmm.
So,
but they all can read from the Torah. That's the interesting part. I mean, most of the Oriental
correct,
Jews.
Correct.
Yehiel can read
The Taimanim were taught to read from every direction.
Oh, really?
They didn't have that many books.
Oh.
So, really? You know, The Rebbe would sit over here and the kids would gather around. The one who was sitting on that side would learn how to read upside down. This one who was sitting over here would learn how to read sideways.
The guy that read upside down would have to put the paper turned around and he didn't know how to read it.
Maybe not.
So the term for the Taimani is translated Yemenite?
Yemenite,
So that's the Hebrew term for it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. The word Taiman is mentioned in the Bible many, many times. And it means, you know, the south. Or, in this particular case, southern Arabia, southern part of the Arabian Peninsula. Of course, a lot of people say that the word Taiman is related to the word Yamin. You know what Yamin means? Yamin means the right hand. Why? Because if you face east, then where is the south? It's where your right hand is. You see.
Right.
So that
would be down
there. And this is the reason why, incidentally, well, in Hebrew you have, for example, for east, you have the word Mizrach, which of course is from the word Zarach, meaning to shine, because this is the place where
the sun,
begins shining, right? But at the same time, you have another word, and that's Kedem. Kedem means right ahead of you, straight ahead of you, you see. Forward.
Okay.
Yeah, but it's a synonym for the word east.
Kedem is also.
Yeah, Kedem is a synonym for east, right. So that for the south, you have the word Darom, and then you have the word. In the Bible, they use various words like Teimam, Teimana, and so on. And then they also use the word Negba, to the Negev. Why? Because the southern part of Eretz Israel is the Negev, you see. So, and then of course the West, this we normally use the word.